Hey y'all, it's your host Machido, and I'm here with a brand new episode of the What the Fuck podcast. We're here, we're driven by the facts. Again, What the Fuck will be delving into a topic and getting to the FAQs, where I'll be doing my best to provide any necessary updates, with your help of course, while heavily relying on research, keeping current with the news and what's going on in our world, all in an effort to decipher the noise and turn it into something we can all digest. Y'all know what's up. Let's turn those what the fucks into uh-huhs. Now let's start the show.
Dude, what the fuck?
Interestingly enough, a few weeks ago, I went down a rabbit hole that sunk deeper into the all but rosy history of childbirth. When I couldn't stomach any more, I cut myself from the hypothetical umbilical cord that is the internet, but right before I closed my laptop, I noticed discussions around a certain scene from the House of the Dragon premiere. At the top of the episode, an uncomfortably pregnant Queen Aemma foreshadows her fate. The childbed is our battlefield, she says. We must learn to face it with a stiff lip. Meanwhile, her husband, King Viserys, is ominously confident that this pregnancy, after a run of miscarriages and stillbirths, will finally produce a male heir. Instead, the queen's labor reaches a dangerous impasse. The Grand Maester informs the king that the baby is in a breech position and that it is sometimes necessary for the father to make an impossible choice, to sacrifice one or to lose them both. Viserys approves the surgical removal of the baby without Aemma's knowledge or consent. As birth attendants restrain their desperate and confused queen, the Grand Maester slices into her belly. The queen dies, and her baby dies soon after. In George R.R. Martin's Fire and Blood, the book on which House of the Dragon is based, the queen dies in childbirth in an unspecified manner, but only in the show does it become something rather gruesome. In a series of interviews, Miguel Sapochnik, one of the showrunners and the episode's director, exhaustively explained the residents of the choice. The scene, intercut with a bloody jousting tournament mounted by the king in premature celebration, was designed to be a distillation of the experience of men and the experience of women in Westeros. But it is also meant to reveal parallels into our own past and present, Sapochnik added. It represents the grimness of childbirth in the medieval era, from which Martin's fantasy world draws, when giving birth was violence. But it also represents the grimness of childbirth in post-Roe America, when the scene reads as more timely and impactful than ever. Anxious not to get it wrong, eager not to shy away, but also not to sensationalize, the creative team, which was comprised, written, directed, edited, majorly, majority, most of which was done by a man, couldn't find the adjective there, enlisted two midwives to advise on set and innumerable women to screen the sequence before it aired. The scene, Sapochnik promised, was just the beginning of a whole season of intense births, each seeded with additional gender commentary. Yikes. The theme of this birth, he explained, was torture. So after seeing all of this, plus my earlier readings on childbirth, it was only fitting for the topic of this week to be childbirth. Before we get into the topic of this week, just wanted to go ahead and make a quick note that predominantly we will be discussing things based off of a Western lens. So specifically looking at childbirth and birth rates in the United States and also in Europe as well. Not as much, but also Europe as well. So I did just want to make sure that I was clear and transparent here that although childbirth, yes, is a very universal topic, for this episode specifically, we will be getting into the tragedies, the specifics around the dangers and, you know, pretty much just the disturbing and shameful history of childbirth in the Western Hemisphere.
Yay!
So one thing that definitely stood out to me, I'm kind of forgetting which characters were having this discussion, but in the House of the Dragon premiere, when a couple of the male characters, this is when they are planning for the jousting tournament in celebration of this alleged son that Queen Emma is going to go ahead and birth. But it was around this discussion that I'm not quite sure which character it was, but he mentioned that, you know, it's pretty much a 50% chance of either success or death, either for the mother, either for the child, or maybe even for both when it comes to childbirth during these times. And again, just a reminder that House of the Dragon and a lot of George R.R. Martin's content is based around medieval times. That being said, bearing a child is still one of the most dangerous things a woman can still do in present times. It's the sixth most common cause of death among women aged 20 to 34 in the United States. If you look at the black box warning on a packet of birth control pills, I don't know if you ever read that, you'll notice that at most ages, the risk of death from taking the pills is less than if you don't take them. And that's because they're so good at preventing pregnancy, and pregnancy kills. The risk flips only after age 35 because birth control pills increase the risk of stroke. Psst. Guys, side note over here. You know what makes an excellent 35th birthday present for your partner? Maybe getting a vasectomy, especially in these times. I don't know, just putting that out there since that is something that is reversible. But anyways, I tangent.
Happy birthday!
In the United States today, about 15 women die in pregnancy or childbirth per 100,000 live births. That's way too many. But a century ago, it was more than 600 women per 100,000 births. In the 1600s and 1700s, the death rate was twice that. By some estimates, between 1 and 1.5% of women giving birth died. Note that the rate is per birth, so the lifetime risk of dying in childbirth was much higher, perhaps even closer to 5%. In terms of evolution, childbirth seems like an exceptionally bad time to die. If by definition, the ultimate measure of evolutionary success is reproducing successfully, the fact that women and newborns frequently died in childbirth suggests that powerful selective forces must be at work. So why is childbirth such an ordeal? Compared to other primates, human infants are born ridiculously underdeveloped. They can't do much more than suck and scream, let's be honest. They would be better off if they could gestate longer, but the mother wouldn't be. The classic explanation for why human infants are born at such an early stage of development has to do with the anatomical limits on the woman's hips. If the fetal head had time to grow any larger in utero, the baby wouldn't fit through the pelvic girdle, and the pelvic girdle can't get any wider on a woman before she is not able to walk efficiently. This is called the obstetric dilemma hypothesis, and it's been dominant for many years, but it's almost certainly wrong, or at least not the full story. Anthropologist Holly Dunsworth and her colleagues found that broadening the pelvis wouldn't actually interfere with walking, and they point out the gestation is actually pretty long in humans compared to other primates. Even though newborn newborns' brains are relatively less developed. Other researchers suggest that the problem of obstructed labor, when a baby basically gets stuck in the birth canal, seems to have become common fairly recently in human history. The real reason women give birth when they do, Dunsworth says, is that it would take much too much energy to feed a fetus for any longer. This is the metabolic hypothesis, and it's based on the finding that the maximum metabolic rate people can sustain is about 2 or 2.5 times their standard rate of using energy. During the third trimester, that's exactly how much metabolic activity the pregnancy demands. Carrying a fetus for those final few months is like being an incredibly good athlete, Dunsworth says. Yeah, no wonder it's so exhausting. By the late stages of pregnancy and during childbirth, almost anything can go wrong. Pregnant women are sapped of energy. They're susceptible to infectious disease. The baby's head is enormous. Labor also takes much longer in humans than in other primates, and women often pushed for days. Historically, women died of fever or childbed fever or postpartum sepsis, an infection usually contracted during childbirth. Other causes of death included hemorrhaging or eclampsia, which is dangerously high blood pressure that leads to organ damage. Also, obstructed labor could be a source of death as well. So, given all these dangers, how exactly did deaths in childbirth fall to about 1/50th of the historic rate? Life expectancy in the United States and the developed world basically doubled in the past 150 years, and a decrease in maternal mortality is ultimately a big reason for our longer, healthier lives. But the history of childbirth death rates is complicated and disturbing. It's a story of hubris, mistrust, greed, incompetence, and turf battles that live on to today. Today's sponsor is FaceFacts, a fax machine for your face. Tired of standing out from the crowd? Embarrassed your makeup style doesn't look like everyone else's? Face it, you're probably too lazy to learn how to bake, contour, highlight, or use eyeliner as lip liner. Or wait, is it lip liner as eyeliner? Anyway, it's okay, don't stress, because boy, does FaceFacts have a solution for you. Like a filter on social media, pick any of the three available makeup looks that everyone has these days from the settings, click print, and voila! All you have to do is apply the printed sheet to your face, while the ink is still wet of course, and boom, you're done. You can choose to fill in or add any other details if you'd like, although staged imperfection is all the rave. So what are you waiting for? Go to facefacts.net and put in offer code FAQERS at checkout to get your first order free. Now let's get back to the show. The death rate in the overall population started dropping at the end of the 1800s, and it dropped most dramatically during the first few decades of the 20th century. Childbirth deaths were different. They actually increased during the first few decades of the 20th century. So what was going on here? Even though pregnant women had less exposure to disease and were more likely to have clean water, proper nutrition, safe food, and comfortable housing than at any previous time in human history, they died in droves in childbed. The main culprit here was the doctors. For most of European and US history, midwives had attended births. Some were incompetent, some were skilled. The best ones wrote and read reports on techniques and treatments, and there's some evidence that they were becoming better trained and having better outcomes during the early 1800s. Doctors had little to do with childbirth. They were all men, and it was considered obscene for a man to be present at a birth. As the profession of medicine grew during the 1800s, though, doctors started to edge their way into the potentially lucrative business of childbirth. The first ones were general practitioners who had no training and little experience in childbirth. It was considered a low-status specialty and wasn't taught well or at all in most medical schools. In the delightfully named book, Get Me Out! A History of Childbirth from the Garden of Eden to the Sperm Bank, Randy Hutter Epstein describes the state-of-art treatment. Before forceps, babies stuck in the birth canal were dragged out by the doctor, often in pieces. Sometimes midwives cracked the skull, killing the newborn, but sparing the mother. Sometimes doctors broke the pubic bone, which often killed the mother, but spared the baby. Doctors had an entire arrangement and use of gruesome gadgets to hook, stab, and rip apart a hard-to-deliver baby. Many of these gadgets had an uncanny resemblance to medieval torture tools.
Dude, what the fuck?
The biggest danger to expectant mothers was infection. Before the germ theory of disease, people suspected childbed fever could somehow be contagious, and they knew that some midwives and doctors had worse records than others, but no one knew how it was transmitted. To avoid blame for maternal deaths, doctors lied on death certificates. They'd attribute a new mother's death to fever rather than childbed fever, or mention hemorrhage without mentioning that the hemorrhage was caused by childbirth. In the mid-1800s, Ignaz Semmelweis discovered that doctors in his hospital in Vienna were spreading childbed fever when they went directly from performing autopsies to delivering babies. But his work was mostly ignored. There were many reasons for this. He was apparently a real pill. The methods he suggested for sanitizing the hands were caustic and difficult, and most doctors attending births at home hadn't been near a corpse. Doctors were also offended by this accusation that their filth was responsible for deadly disease. After all, gentlemen didn't have dirty hands. The best source of historic information on this subject is a book called Death in Childbirth, an international study of maternal care and maternal mortality from the 1800s to 1950 by Irving Lowndon. If you are pregnant, whatever you do, do not read this book. It's a very serious work, rich in data and graphs and analysis, but you can tell he's furious about all the unnecessary deaths at the beginning of the 20th century. Here's how he described childbed fever. A woman could be delivered on Monday, happy and well with her newborn baby on Tuesday, feverish and ill by Wednesday evening, delirious and in agony on Thursday, and dead on Friday or Saturday. During the 1920s in the United States, half of the maternal deaths were caused by childbed fever. For a disease that was preventable by ordinary intelligence and careful training, he wrote, these figures were a reproach to civilized nations. One piece of evidence Lowndon uses to attribute blame for unnecessary early 20th century deaths to doctors is that rich women were more likely to die in childbirth than poor women. For almost any other cause of death, the poor were more likely to die than the rich. But for childbirth, poor women could afford only midwives. Rich women could afford doctors. Doctors, in turn, had to justify their fees and distinguish themselves from lowly midwives by providing new tools and techniques. Flashback to those, you know, torture tools that slightly resembled medieval times that many doctors were using during this time period. Death rates in childbirth finally began to drop in the 1930s with the introduction of sulfa antibiotics that were highly effective against the streptococcal bacteria responsible for most cases of childbed fever. Doctors cleaned up their acts as well. A series of reports in the 1940s had linked high death rates to improper medical procedures. Training improved and doctors abandoned the most dangerous techniques. Complications from C-sections declined steadily. Medical researchers now rigorously evaluated success rates and risks of new techniques and drugs as well. Additionally, nutrition improved, meaning that there were fewer women with rickets. Rickets, as we know, causes bone deformations, which led to the obstructions or obstructed births in the late 19th and early 20th century.
prenatal care also became a standard part of medical practice. Reliable, safe, and legal birth control allowed women to limit and time their pregnancies, and it led to a decrease in illegal abortions, a leading cause of death in pregnant women historically. Improved maternal survival eventually did turn into one of the great public health and medical achievements of the 20th century. It just took a really long time to get there. The good news today is that globally, maternal mortality is continuing to decrease. More women are surviving childbirth, and that's a big reason and one of the most joyful reasons why lifespan is continuing to climb in the 21st century.
Yay!
The midwives and doctors, though, yeah, they're still tussling.
And by the way, I have a question, and don't fight me because I know how you girls like to tussle.
Midwives accuse doctors of endangering women by continuing to perform too many unnecessary procedures. Doctors accuse midwives of allowing pregnant women and newborns to die of preventable deaths. The main battlefield today is over home births. About 1% of women in the United States choose to give birth at home. Counterintuitive as it may sound at first, they often cite safety concerns. They're worried about unnecessary procedures if they give birth in a hospital, and they trust their body's inherent ability to give birth without interference. Melissa Cheney is an anthropologist at Oregon State University, as well as a home birth advocate and midwife. She reports that women who choose home birth value alternative and more embodied or intuitive ways of knowing. Home birth advocates say women are better off giving birth in a comfortable environment, letting nature take its course. A meta-analysis of outcomes from home births and hospital births shows that women who give birth at home do have fewer procedures and complications, but their newborns are 3 times more likely to die. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists advises that hospitals and birthing centers are the safest places to give birth, and they have published guidelines for how to talk pregnant women out of home birth. Many states are considering or tightening restrictions on midwives and home births, including Idaho, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Indiana, often in response to heartbreaking and infuriating cases of women or infants dying due to incompetent treatment. The Cochrane Collaboration, a highly respected organization that carefully judges medical treatments, analyzed the available evidence, which is admittedly a bit of a mess, but the Cochrane Collaboration concluded that planned home births with low-risk mothers are as safe as hospital births. Once more for emphasis, though, this is only for women who have an extremely low chance of complications and who have access to emergency medical treatment if anything goes wrong. It's tricky to compare outcomes across countries, especially because licensing and training regulations differ, but a Canadian study showed that home births were safe. In the United States, there are 2 main types of midwives: registered nurses who specialize in midwifery and are highly medically trained, and certified professional midwives whose training may be a little less medically rigorous. The conflict between doctors and midwives puts pregnant women in the middle and can be uncomfortable and dangerous in itself. Doctors focus on risks and complications. Midwives focus on a pregnant woman's comfort. Midwives talk about intuition and say pregnancy is the most natural thing in the world. They accuse doctors of lacking empathy, which isn't surprising since medical students get a lot of empathy squeezed out of them during their training. For individual, simple, low-risk births, having a home birth overseen by a highly trained midwife isn't necessarily a clearly terrible decision. But when you take a world historical look at childbirth, it's not midwives and cozy home births that get credit for making maternal death such an unthinkable outcome today. One of the great victories of modern times is that childbirth doesn't need to be natural, and neither does maternal death rate need to be natural as well. It's modern medicine for the win. Doctors may have killed a lot of women in the first part of the 20th century, but they can save a life today. But ultimately, at the end of the day, this birthing, pregnancy, childbirth, all of this, again, is a decision that should be left up to the mother ultimately and the partnership that created the said child. This is a perfect segue into the ludicrous stage that we're in, specifically here in the United States, with the dissolvement of Roe versus Wade, the post-Roe America, as it's been termed. And I just want to say for the record, at the end of the day, it is completely a person's choice how they get pregnant, when they get pregnant, and how they choose to deliver said pregnancy.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special report.
The news segment seeks to highlight and bring us up to speed on some of the trending stories globally, nationally, locally, and of course, in the celebrity sphere.
So Serena creates trouble for herself early, but then escapes a pair of aces, turning that game around.
For what's been on most people's radar this week in terms of news, we'll start off with Serena Williams. So if you haven't heard this, or if you haven't been paying attention to the tennis world, Serena Williams took to the court this last Monday for the first match of what's anticipated to be her last U.S. Open. Earlier this month, Williams, now 40, announced her plans to retire from tennis after a decades-long career in which she dominated and transformed the women's game. And let's not forget, within this whole span of her illustrious career, my sister won 23 Grand Slam singles titles. And that's not even touching the doubles titles that she won with her sister Venus as well. So before we dive into the more complicated and serious news of this week, just want to say my congratulations. And to just say, honestly, it's been an honor as a Black woman, or just as a woman, as a person, honestly, to have been conscious and alive during this very historic time period that Serena Williams gave us in terms of the tennis world. So congrats to that legend. Happy retirement, Serena. In the science and medical sphere, the Food and Drug Administration authorized reformulated versions of the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines that aim to protect against the Omicron variant. The new shots target both the original strain of the coronavirus and the Omicron BA.5, BA.4 subvariants that most people are catching now. This double-barreled vaccine is called a bivalent vaccine. The Moderna COVID-19 vaccine is authorized for use as a single booster dose in people 18 and older. The Pfizer booster is authorized for people 12 years and up. People are eligible for the new boosters 2 months after completing their initial vaccination or their last booster shot. Moving on, although Hispanic Heritage Month doesn't begin until September 15, DC Comics got an early start by revealing several special covers in their attempt to celebrate the upcoming month. The covers, which were revealed in June, feature several of DC's superheroes surrounded by, holding, or eating a variety of Latin American foods such as tacos, flan, tamales, and plátanos fritos. Comic book fans on Twitter, specifically Latino fans, aren't too happy with this interpretation of DC's heroes. Have y'all seen these covers? What are your thoughts? Lastly, the suspect in an apparent assassination attempt against Argentine Vice President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner was arrested last year for improper use of a weapon, police have stated. Argentine authorities have identified Fernando Sabag Montiel as the suspect who approached Fernandez de Kirchner with a loaded gun outside her home in Buenos Aires on Thursday in what appears to be a failed assassination attempt. Sabag Montiel had a weapons permit but was arrested in 2021 for carrying a large knife in public. Police spokespersons later illustrated and added that Sabug Montiel has at least one tattoo with Nazi symbols as well. Migration office officials said he was born in the Brazilian city of Sao Paulo on January 13, 1987, and had been living in Argentina since 1993. Video of the incident shows Fernandes de Kirchner smiling as she walks by a large crowd of supporters. A man then surges forward and points a gun at her face. No bullets were fired and the vice president was unharmed, though the Argentine Ministry of Security later confirmed the .380 firearm used in the incident had bullets inside. Alrighty, listeners, that concludes another episode of the What the Fuck podcast. Thank you so much to everyone for tuning in and again for always showing your support and your love. I greatly appreciate it. If you want to find other ways to support this podcast, you can find me on social media. Again, my handle is at the FAQPOD. On Instagram and Twitter as well. If you prefer to send in emails, I welcome those too. You can go ahead and send those over to thefaqpod@gmail.com. Again, thank you so much for your support. I can't thank you enough. With that, I hope everyone takes care and enjoys the rest of their week. Bye-bye.